Money kept rolling in from every side.
Baby's pretty hands reached out and they reached wide. Now you may feel it should have been a voluntary cause. Ah, but that's not the point, my friends. When the money keeps rolling in, you don't ask how. Think of all the people gonna see some good times now.
Good evening, this is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 424, January 18th, 1980, side one. That song is called The Money Keeps Rolling In. It has to do with money that was put in the Swiss bank accounts of Eva Perón. Last week and the week before, I did tapes about Frank Turple, George Kirkola, and John Dutcher, three men that were arrested December the 24th in New York City at the Hilton Hotel. There's very little in the news. I'm going to be updating the terror on the right. One of the known assassins, John Dutcher, who works with silencers, assassination weapons, assassination teams, and is an acknowledged assassin of the highest level, was released. Two men, Frank Turple and George Kirkola, were arrested and given a small amount, I think it was $100,000 each bail put up for them or bond. And there's been a total news blackout. But we will be referring to these men constantly because they were a link to the ODESA, the international Nazi organization that has been going on ever since the end of World War II. They are proof positive that their organizations and front organizations work with the CIA, the Secret Service, Scotland Yard, and the law enforcement in the United States funding what is known as third world terrorism and violence. And I want to go into the definition of what third world is. Third world means Third Reich. There's a combination of art dealers, gun runners, and narcotics. And the danger now is that the judges, the district attorneys, the courts are totally in the control of these people, so they escape easily, and or they're murdered, the witnesses are murdered, and that the pattern of the justice system being perverted by murder that I've been watching all these years fits together like a hand in a glove. And these two men were just part of a worldwide organization. If you want to know, I suppose, what's going on in the Middle East or my view of it, you almost have to hear the back tapes going on 7 or 8 years, because I was crying continuously. We are on the verge of World War III, and that's the only place we can be headed. And as the boats steam up and the restrictions go on and the isolation of Russia goes on, I don't think Japan or Germany or the United States would hesitate to try to make war. I think that the move into Afghanistan of the Soviet Union was to secure more borders for them, because once NATO insisted that we have atomic missiles aimed at the Soviet Union from seven countries, and once Mr. Park was killed in Korea and it made it possible to unite North and South Korea, and he was killed by our own CIA, and the Shah was out, I think that the Soviet Union had to make a move at this time from a position of stronger now than they will be 10 years from now, and it was very necessary that the CIA not continue to give Amin this money in Afghanistan, arming him with napalm and weapons, and they moved strategically there, which caught us by surprise. These major events don't just happen. The Soviet Union going into Afghanistan is a defensive move. If they took the whole Middle East, it would be a defensive move, not an aggressive move, because of the alignment of weapons and missiles and atomic proliferation that we're going to escalate. The Soviet Union warned us, don't stop the SALT agreements. We can't afford either of us to escalate the arms. The minute the paper was signed, it was photographed on television, and it was up to the Congress to vote. Our Congress decided that they would never go along with SALT, and I believe that the Soviet Union realizes that, and as I say, they're going to move forward now. Another point which I want to make, which is terribly important, is that people are expendable. They are unimportant. You may think you're important, but you don't matter. Your lives or your taxes and what you work for to give to these war makers is just a transitory thing. Right now, they have all the money they need from gun running and from narcotics and from bank robberies and train robberies or whatever, they can take out of safe deposits. And there's enough gold and silver now to wage this total war against the Soviet Union, if that's what they want. But you and I are expendable. The name of the game is power, and it's profits, and it's vengeance, wanting to go in and grabbing Russia. And I don't think that there's much that's going to stop in the way. The church has always been a way of covering up or justifying the control of people. That's the third point I want to make. The first is that these events don't just happen. The second is that people are expendable. The third is the church has covered up these power grabs, these profit grabs. We depend upon the church. Most people do. It either baptizes the babies, the new ones, or bar mitzvahs, or marries people and buries them, and everybody wants to have a religious send-off, somebody that links them with God. But the church also has been the conduit for the passports. Eva Perón went to the Vatican to get passports for the Nazi war criminals who killed 1 million, 30,000, 40,000, 20,000 mass murderers, were given passports from the Vatican with false identifications. And then a man like Martin Bormann not only got a false identification from the Vatican after Eva Perón went to the Vatican for this purpose, or went to Italy for a meeting with these people, but then when Bormann arrives in Argentina, they give him a new citizenship with a background of being a Polish person, a geologist, and a Jewish name, Goldstein, in return for housing these people and bringing them to Argentina. Then they go to Brazil and Chile, Paraguay, Bolivia, in return for that. All of the wealth of Europe was put into bank accounts of Eva Perón, and then she took it to Switzerland, where it was kept until she died at age 32. And then there was a reemergence of the Nazis and the escalation of weapon sales and narcotic traffic, plus the accumulated wealth that could unleash, as a time bomb in 1952, the resurgence of the Nazis all over the world. The fourth point I want to make about the subject in general, about Iran or Afghanistan or what's going on now, is that there have always been wars, hatreds, jealousies, and land grabs. The only thing that makes us different now is that we had the means to end it and we didn't use it. We have the technology for survival, and the people just don't want to scream, you know, to grow or produce the things which we need that are healthy and useful, and we still are making weapons for destruction that have no purpose except to proliferate death and refugees and eliminate painfully millions of the population. Education, I believe, is an illusion. It's perverted. It's turned around. Free will is limited to what you can do. Freedom to speak up is also limited. There are no such things as famous trials of political people, and even at the lower level. There's an illusion, a limited illusion. You can speak out to a point, but even when you speak, there's only so much you can say. The major industries that control all these warfare mentalities are oil, weapons, narcotics, and health. Oil is your transportation. That's what gets it together, boats, planes, and trains. It moves the weapons, and it keeps the armies going. The satellites, the missiles, the guns and tanks, the chemicals, the germs, the hydrogen bombs, the atom bombs, and so forth. The ships, the planes, the weapons. And then narcotics control the youth, the masses. That you can control entire nations. You control the police departments and pay off international police, Interpol, the drug agencies. And then the money is used for smuggling and dealing and killing and controlling masses, because you can link political murders to drug deaths and drug contacts and so forth. And you can be drugged yourself to the point of submissiveness to these people who control. And then health, your mind, your body, how much cancer you'll have, germs, is very much going to be controlled by institutions such as the Muse Medical Institute, the Rockefeller Medical Institute. There was even a Pahlavi Medical Institute that the Shah was running. The methods of profits, of keeping us doing exactly what they want us to do, come through your energies, your weapons, your narcotics, and your medical and health plans. The Roman Empire wanted to rule the world. Alexander the Great wanted to rule. Napoleon Bonaparte tried twice against Russia. The word Waterloo means to meet your your failure. He couldn't do it then, but then the Germans tried in World War I. They tried again in World War II, and by May 1943, that important period is when the Nazis went underground. I mentioned that on several tapes, a book by Kurt Rees, but this is documented over and over in other books. The seeds of this confrontation of World War III were made in May 1943 when it was impossible for the Germans to penetrate inside the Soviet Union and take Stalingrad, and that was the turning point. They had to retrench Mr. Kaltenbrunner and Heinrich Himmler and so forth to go underground. The plans were for Martin Bormann to take all the artifacts, the gold, the silver, the dollars, the pounds, to Argentine. And as I say, he put it in the bank account name of Eva Duarte Perón, and she took it to Switzerland. From 1945 to 1950 was this mass of people, Nazis. Some stayed in Germany for a long time, like Mengele's, who did the experimentations and decisions of who died at Auschwitz. He lived under his family name, and when he found that anybody even disliked him or wanted him, he went on down to South America very late in the game. And many of them just used their names and got out easily. Bormann made sure that he had these aliases that were arranged by Eva Duarte Perón by going to Italy and making sure that he left, because he was the man behind the resurgence of the Nazi movement that is appearing, and you'll see more of it later, but it's just beginning to consume the world. Without armbands and marching, it's moving along, and that's why it isn't so obvious. Eva Perón, as I say, arranged for passports for these Nazis and set up what is known as the Spider or the Odessa. She unleashed through their organization all the diamonds and wealth that they needed to escalate what would become known as a Christian war, because communists had not only divided up the property and the land and confiscated the Tsar's property and wealth, but there were other reasons for wanting to avenge this war, and that was that the Western world had so many investments in the Soviet Union. It wasn't just that the Russians were changing forms of government. It was that the British and the Americans were losing their investments that were specifically put into a country known then as Russia. I've mentioned on other tapes the book The Great Conspiracy Against Russia by Michael Sayers and Albert Kahn, and it talked about the investments that Herbert Hoover, who became president of the United States, had in Russia before the Soviets took over. There are sections in that book about the Eastern Campaign, how in 1919, the United States and Great Britain sent armies into Russia to try and stop the revolution. And there was a man named Mr. Rangel, who later came to the United States, Baron Rangel, and he became very much a part of Hitler's Nazi Germany, and then he was related to George de Morenschild, the R.V. Oswald's closest friend in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Rangel was a long, long Nazi, Baron Rangel. He left Poland. He had tried to fight with the Red Army when the revolution took place. And I've mentioned on other tapes how Herbert Hoover, an Englishman, an English geologist, well-known on two continents, the United States and Great Britain, had put millions and millions of dollars into relief funds at the disposal of the Polish. There's $40 million of relief funds to keep the Polish army fighting the Soviet Union when they came to power. In the book, The Great Conspiracy, it describes Siberia. It said it seemed that Siberia, with all its riches, was destined to fall in the hands of the Japanese. The Japanese had 70,000 troops in Siberia. The British, the United States, and the Japanese fought the Red Army, and hundreds and thousands and millions were killed. The price was tremendous for the Russians to hold on to the revolution. But there's also in this book what they call a chapter on the accounting, Chapter 7, that after the revolution took place, the Russians had lost 7 million men, women, and children from starvation and disease, that the government had lost $60 million, but the Allies in the United States and Great Britain had lost a great amount of money in fighting Russia, and they had investments. There was in the book, The Great Conspiracy, the author said, "What were the motives behind such a futile and costly undeclared war against Russia at the turn of the century when the revolution took place there, and the Great Britain and the United States were so anxious to keep the Red Army out of control in that country so far away. And the answer was that the white generals, the white Russians, were frankly fighting for restoration of their own great Russia. They wanted landed estates, profits, and class privileges. But the main thing was that anti-Bolshevism was just a secondary role. It said there was northern Russian timber, there was coal, there was Siberian gold, Caucasian oil that was carried out. This was also pumped by companies in Europe that were dealing with this oil. It said there was a British plan for a Trans-Caucasian Federation. They wanted to seal off India from Russia. They wanted to make possible exclusive British domination of the oil fields in the Near East. The Japanese plan was conquest and colonization of Siberia. The French plan was to gain control in the Donets, that's where the coal was, and the Black Sea area. And the ambitious long-range German plan was to seize the Baltic states and the Ukraine. One of the very first acts of the Soviet government when they assumed power was to nationalize the economic trust of the Tsarist Empire. This is from the book The Great Conspiracy. The Russian mines, the mills, the factories, the railroads, the oil wells, the industrial enterprises. So that the Tsarist Empire, this is from this book, a quote, for all its outward show of wealth and power, was actually a semi-colony of the English French, the Anglo-French, and the German financial interests. Just as Iran belonged to Russia and to the English Iranian oil companies that took over all of the oil and the people in Iran, the Tsarist Empire was actually a bunch of investments of the English and French that had colonies and the German interests, and that what the Tsar had actually was involved with French financing, that there was a sum of 17,591,000,000 francs invested in Tsarist Russia. The Anglo-French interests controlled no less than 72% of Russian coal, iron, steel, and 50% of all Russian oil. There were several hundred million francs and pounds in dividends and profits and interest drawn from the labor of Russian workers and Russian peasants. We don't look at the Soviet Union as belonging to France, Germany, Russia, and Japan, but the intent was there in 1919, and nothing has happened that's any different since. They feel that their investments would still be flowing if they could take control of the country. The book The Great Conspiracy says that in 1918, combined British and French investments in Russia were, at that time, 1,600,000,000 sterling, or close to $8 billion at the time, and that Marshal Foch, when he talked about being opposed to peace with Russia and the French, they didn't mean a French democracy. They meant an exploitation of billions of dollars. This book goes into Royal Dutch Shell Company, whose Russian interests had included the Ural Caspian Oil Company, the North Caucasian oil fields, the new Shibarev Petroleum Company, and other oil concerns. There were the British arms manufacturers, Metro Vickers, and the French, and the Schneider, Creusot, and the German Krupps, that sold the Tsar ammunition, and this was an industry, and banking houses of Britain and France. The Hoares, the Barling Brothers, Hambros, Credit Lyon, Societe Generale, Rothschild, Comptoir National, and so forth. All these interests wanted the Soviet Union, that huge mass of land, with its all of its resources of gold and timber and coal and oil and the seas and ports, to be divided between France and England and Japan. And the oil in Baku was what it's described as incomparable. Baku is greater than any oil city in the world. And oil is king, and Baku is the throne. So the seeds of World War III were planted when the white Russian, the Tsarist, was kicked out, and the French and the English and the Royal Dutch Shell wanted their investments. They wanted to sell weapons back there. They wanted to take the oil, the coal, and the natural resources of Russia. And the Japanese had decided to divide up their interests in Siberia, wealthy Siberia. I did mention one, the holdings, the financial holdings of Herbert Hoover alone were over $1 billion in property, 2,500,000 acres of land, 12 developed mines, 2 copper smelters. And by 1912, he had huge investments in the Tsar's regime, 1909 rather. Herbert Hoover had Russian oil wells, and within 1 year he had 11 oil companies. So he would be a natural to become president of the United States and take money that was feeding the poor to arm these people that went to Germany, became they used Adolf Hitler as their front to be the avenger to take back their investments in what is known as Russia now. So it isn't that the Russians were hard on their people or cruel or that they didn't have freedoms. The Russians were forced to tighten their belt because from the moment of the revolution they were being attacked by Great Britain, Japan, the Royal Dutch Shell, the Netherlands, and England for what they had there because they were so rich in resources, just as the continent of Africa is rich in resources. It becomes a battlefield and it's up for grabs. And the motives for the war are always clouded, but again, it's money and power and investments of pulling the oil, the forests, the coal, the diamonds, the gold, and ruling the world. It's been a goal of a few crazy people, and it just seems to continuously go on. The seeds of the war that is going on in your newspapers every day was planted in 1919, when the thought that Russia could take away these investments from countries in Europe and Asia so frightened them that they were determined to get back their investments and put themselves back on the throne with the same wealth and power they had before. Because of the escalation of the war taking place now and the arrest of those international terrorists that are linked to these Nazi connections that were formed after World War One was over with the Tsarists and the creation of the Nazi Party, I want to go into sections of a book which you all must read if you haven't read it already. And if you've read it once, read it again and read it very closely because I'll be referring to it many times. It's called Aftermath by Ladislas Ferrigo. And he describes how he went searching for Martin Bormann, Hitler's right-hand man, who died May the 2nd, 1945, several days before Hitler was supposed to have died. But Ferrigo did go to South America. And in telling the search for Martin Bormann, you get the way the network or the funding and the intent and the power and the money, the seeds that were planted for what is taking place today. And I think it's very important for me as a historian to share with you the seeds that were planted. And the daily news is plentiful, and we can put that together in the years to come, hopefully. But I want to share with you certain sections of the book about Aftermath and Martin Bormann. On page 241, he describes in 1947, and again, we've mentioned that on the tapes before, but it's so terribly important, how the Secretary of the Vatican, Mr. Montini, who became Pope Paul VI, was writing passports as a secretary of the Vatican for an Argentine, for persons to go leave the Vatican, leave their place of seclusion, and go to South America and begin the resurgence of this movement over in South America, because the continent of Europe after World War II was completely shattered and apart, and the Nazis were forced to go underground and keep a low key. This is important because when Pope John Paul I was pope for 30 days, he died, and there were cartoons in Rome about his being murdered and many discussions of it, and he was buried immediately. And the Pope John Paul II, the current pope, has links to this international terrorist group, and his role at Auschwitz or with IG Farben or with Prince Bernhard are so carefully concealed, and he was the direct protege and inherited this chain of command of the Odessa from Montini and from the Vatican, which plays an important part in this story, and then links it to gun running, narcotics, and organized crime. And, of course, Montini was in the OSS, which then became the CIA. The Pope from the Vatican was actually in the United States OSS. He was in Italy, but it was a agency of the United States government, and he was a member of it. As I say before, Signora Maria Duarte de Peron, that's Eva Peron, then the play they call her Evita, that's little Eva, wife of Juan Peron, went to Italy and had a meeting in Rapallo, that's near Genoa. And that was where the arrangements were made for Martin Bormann to go to South America, to Argentina, where they helped him out when he got there. he was to take on the name of a family of Jewish-Italian descent. He first left the country, in quotes, as a philosopher, his passport, and he got the name of Luido Boglidio, which was changed later. And July 10th, 1947, Signor Perone took two Italian generals and put pressure on the bishop to collaborate and conceal the identity of Martin Bormann. Signora Perone went there, but then her banks and her money would reap the profit. About 75% of the money that was taken down, a good deal of it went right to the Perones and then later was used to continue the Nazi work. But they got paid very heavily for allowing Martin Bormann to go down there. It wasn't completely altruistic. And then some of it she gave to a front charity to look as if she was helping little children in the Perone Foundation. When he left Genoa, Martin Bormann left Genoa in 1948, got in Argentine May 17, 1948. He changed his name to Eliezer Goldstein. They wanted that name. Originally, he used the alias of Juan Gomez. That name comes out at the time of Watergate. It's kind of a common name, but interesting. And Mr. Gomez, I have to look up that alias, dressed as a Jesuit priest, and then went down and took on a Jewish name. He was met by two top officials of the Perón government, Ludwig Frude and General Juan Batista Sosa Molin, Minister of War for Juan Perón. And then they discarded the Vatican passport and issued him a new one as a geologist. And then his background was supposed to be from Warsaw, Poland, incidentally. The man who ran the radio factory that I said was the Nazi connection of Lee Harvey Oswald and a CIA connection in Minsk was a man whose passport said he went from Poland to Argentine, and then he ends up in Minsk radio factory where Lee Harvey Oswald met Marina Oswald, who was a white czarist Russian, and George de Morenschild was like a godfather to her. The man whose father was head of the Nobel oil fields that they wanted so badly, the Belgian Royal Dutch Shell and Nobel oil companies wanted the Baku oil fields. George de Morenschild's father was director of the oil fields, and he befriended Marina, but the passport of Mr. Bormann has the same profile as the same Alexander Zeiger who ended up with Marina and introduced her to Lee in Minsk. The name chosen for him to leave the country was made in Rapallo, Italy, but then the Eliezer Goldstein was chosen. They dumped the Gomez name and gave him a Jewish name. And then in Argentina in 1948, he got a blue stamp by the federal police to stay there. Now, the resurgence of the Nazis became very thick, and they had a meeting in Egypt in 1948 because that's when Israel became a country, and Otto Skorzeny and many top Nazis from Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Paraguay, Bolivia went to Egypt to decide on what to do with the Jewish problem of Israel. And a lot of the money from the Third Reich, the Third World money that is funded, again, going back to these terrorists, to Idi Amin, the Palestine Liberation Army, Gaddafi in Libya, this is all Nazi money that is being funded. The American government doesn't have to look anti-Semitic. They're funding through Nazi funds that were Martin Bormann's that went into the Perón Bank and was later disseminated from Geneva and Lucerne, Switzerland through these bank accounts, is being used for violently anti-Semitic groups that will eventually wipe out all of Israel that have funded the transporting of Bormann to Argentina, and then the Argentine money put in the Swiss banks. When Israel became a country in 1948, Bormann was tucked down in South America. The top Nazis were in Egypt, and every country surrounding Israel is buying millions and millions of dollars worth of weapons to take care of that situation within the next few years. Now, Eva Perón, this actress, singer, former prostitute who handled this money, was the bag woman or the front woman, profited tremendously. She and Juan Perón profited tremendously when the wealth was taken from Europe. And it was shipped by boat. It wasn't taken over with the Jesuit priests. It was shipped right to Argentine. And in the book, The Aftermath, they have accounting of some of this money that went over. They even made note that he used the name Goldstein because there was so much gold. Figured on the market today with the price of gold of what he took over there in 1947-48, that alone would be worth about $17 billion for the gold alone. On the other side of this tape, I'm going to do more on the seeds of this war and how it got started in South America with the Nazis after World War II. According to Ladislas Farago, the Peruanos seized three-quarters of the money that Martin Bormann brought over, and that they kept. They gave him one-quarter of the money. And, of course, again, that tremendous amount of cash is what has gone beyond the arms purchasing and the narcotics distribution. That little treasure of charity work that Evita Peron had has been used for all of this violence that follows after her death at age 32, the escalation of the violence.
Kept rolling out in all directions, to the poor, to the weak, to the destitute of all complexions. Now cynics claim a little of the cash has gone astray, but that's not the point, my friends. When the money keeps rolling out, you...